This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. We can sometimes forget that India, or the idea of a single unified entity, is not a very old concept. Indian history is complicated and convoluted. Different societies, polities, and cultures rise and fall, ebb and flow, as the political makeup of South Asia changes. Namit Arora, author of Indians, A Brief History of a Civilization, details some of these change in cultures. From the early Harappans, to the Buddhist centers of Nagarjunakonda and Nalanda, and ending at Varanasi, Arora takes his readers on a journey through South Asia's rich and diverse history. Namit Arora chose a life of reading and writing after cutting short his career in the internet industry. Raised in the Hindi belt of India, he lived in Louisiana, the San Francisco Bay Area, and Western Europe, and traveled in scores of countries before returning to India over two decades later in 2013. He is also the author of The Lottery of Birth, a collection of essays, and the novel Love and Loathing in Silicon Valley. Today, Namit and I will talk about the many different cultures featured in his book, Indians. We'll share the stories of some of India's illustrious foreign visitors and what it was like for Namit to research these lost histories. So, Namit, thank you so much for joining me on the Asian Review of Books podcast. Perhaps it's best to start with a big picture view of Indians, A Brief History of a Civilization, which itself is a very grand title. What's the span of history that you cover in this book, and what are some of the major places you discuss?
Great. First of all, thank you, Nicholas, for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here. I begin this book with the Harappan civilization, which arose in the early 3rd millennium BCE. And I end the book in our own day, so the time span is nearly 5,000 years. For the book, I visited six major historical sites whose memory was entirely or substantially lost to us, and we know about them through archaeology. These are Dholavira, Nagarjunakonda, Nalanda, Khajuraho, Vijayanagar, and Varanasi. I describe what these lost worlds were like at their prime, and alongside, I also present the impressions of some of the most famous foreign travelers who visited India.
So, what's the mainstream narrative for India's history, at least in India? And how does this mainstream narrative stray from the actual history of South Asia?
Well, I think the mainstream narrative in Indian history, as probably everywhere else, is the narrative of the dominant class and its ideology, which then also reveals how it strays from actual history, as in what it ends up including and excluding. So if we look at the modern period, I see two or three mainstream narratives for Indian history that follow each other. So, you know, it starts out with colonial historiography, which the British forge in alliance with Indian native informants who happen to be all upper caste Hindus. Not surprisingly, this very influential template of Indian history emphasizes only a small part of the Indian story, which is centered on Brahminical society and its texts. And this narrative has shaped Hindu self-knowledge profoundly. On the one hand, it devalues the extraordinary or ignores the extraordinary range and diversity of Indian social, religious, and cultural life. And on the other, it denigrates the centuries of Muslim rule in India, largely to justify their supposedly more humane and rational colonial rule. A nice little trick there. So that's the first mainstream narrative, and it's notable that key aspects of it live on in the current Hindu nationalist conception of Indian history. And I'll come to that in a minute. Then in the 20th century, many Indian scholars, you know, all fired up by this anti-colonial sentiment and secular nationalism, they start writing Indian history, and a new mainstream now emerges. You know, sometimes we call it the Marxist school, though I often think this is a misnomer. These authors didn't quite have similar ideas about Marxism. And while it was progressive in terms of class and religious inclusion, it was still very upper caste in its biases and blind spots. It really focused on caste as a central organizing principle of Indian society and its corrosive impact on social and cultural life. Now, a third mainstream is emerging lately, which is the Hindu nationalist or the Hindutva narrative, which imagines India as a Hindu nation, and it interprets past events to favor one imagined community of this nation. It elevates the history of upper caste Hindus at the expense of other people's histories. It's chauvinistic. It habitually relies on, you know, dubious evidence and arguments, and it's about honing majoritarian pride. And this Hindutva conception of history is now pretty common, I would say, in the Indian academy and in major cultural institutions. And it has the full and aggressive support from the ruling party, which also now represents this dominant ideology. So this third mainstream, if you will, is the one to reckon with in the near future, I think.
And, you know, it's probably clear from your answer that you think this narrative is incorrect. From your research and writing your book, where do you think this current mainstream strays from what India's history was actually like?
Well, in the same way, that applied to the first version of the colonial narrative, which is that it is very much centered on Hindus, it neglects the experiences of a large number of other communities, and it's centered on an upper caste narrative. And it has devalued all kinds of past traditions and peoples and, you know, their cultures. And so, you know, that's it. In many ways, it's the same. And it is virulently anti-Muslim. And so, you know, there is a large parts of the Indian experience that it overlooks.
So I'd like to start now kind of talking about some of the cultures and cities you bring up in your book. And let's maybe start at the very beginning, the Harappans. So in short, who were the Harappans? And, you know, this is the oldest society you profile in the book. And what place do they have in kind of as you chart India's long history?
I'm very fond of the Harappans, so I'm always happy to talk about them. The Harappans were the people who built the Harappan civilization or the Indus Valley civilization, which came up in what is now Pakistan and Western India. It was contemporary to the ancient Mesopotamian and Egyptian civilizations and was larger than each of them, both in terms of population and territory. And its mature period was from 2600 BCE to 1900 BCE. So they flourished for about 700 years. The Harappans built the first cities in the Indian subcontinent. The first of these was discovered in 1925. And since then, over 1,000 Harappan settlements have been identified. And most of these are tiny hamlets, a few small towns, and five large cities, of which three are in modern Pakistan and two in modern India. In the book, I visit Dholavira, the best excavated Harappan city in India. And it's really an amazing place to wander through. You still find fragments of Harappan pottery and bangles and jewelry lying on the ground, and you can, and a whole bunch of other things, various types of stones which are etched with the sort of games they played and wonderful stuff. And the Harappans are, of course, now the overall civilization, they're, of course, famous for their urban planning, water management, citywide drainage systems. They built the first indoor toilets in the world. And in water engineering, their achievements weren't exceeded for 2,000 years until the Romans. In Dholavira, which is was also back then in an arid region, they built amazing water harvesting systems and 16 giant reservoirs. One of these is 9 times larger than an Olympic-sized pool. And so, I mean, the Harappans actually come across to me as really good civil engineers. They also happen to be a seagoing people and traded as far as the Persian Gulf. And, so these are all various types of material achievements. It was, in some ways, though, it was also a very unusual civilization in that it was substantially egalitarian. So, archaeologists haven't found any palaces like the sort you see in Egypt. Their homes are very similar size. So the gap between the size from the upper crust to the lower class is actually, they're quite similar, just a little larger, little smaller. They had substantial nutritional equality, and they can find this out today by doing skeletal analysis. And then their burial goods are also very similar. So the gaps there are small. Another unusual feature is that they apparently had no temples. None have been found, or evidence of a priestly class. There is no evidence of war in their art, nor have weapons of war been found. And so that makes it really quite unusual. They also worshipped mother goddesses who had, with these wide hips and big breasts, the kind that would become prominent in later Indian art. And, several of their seals depict people in yogic and meditative postures. And in one seal, sitting under a Bodhi tree, very intriguing stuff. And they had a linguistic script, but sadly, it's still undeciphered, so a whole bunch of information is locked away. And this civilization declined around 1900 BCE, and the leading explanation is, regional climate change. So the local monsoon patterns changed, the rains dried up, agriculture became unviable, causing a steady population exodus from the cities and migrations to the south. And, there's good reason to believe that the Harappans spoke a Proto-Dravidian language, which they, of course, took to the south. In fact, they have a close genetic proximity to modern South Indians. And so, so that's the Harappans.
And it's interesting you mentioned kind of the things that are unusual about the Harappans, because you kind of know, what is it, the standard narrative of how civilizations develop is they become agricultural, but then agriculture brings inequality and elite classes, administrators, priests. And it seems like the Harappans are the exception to a pattern we've seen in lots of other early civilizations.
That is right. That is, they do defy the standard narrative. But lately, more and more work in anthropology is turning up. There is a class of, there's a group of scholars which has complicated this narrative. And they are talking about some of the early cities in some parts of the world did not quite have the hierarchy we assumed, you know, and there it was a much more complex process, an uneven process, and that neat picture from earlier times is probably no longer true.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I'd like to move on to the next couple chapters, which deal with some of the Buddhist centers that arose in India. Obviously, one of the major historical shifts in India is the decline of Buddhism. Obviously, India is the source of the Buddhist religion, and it was a major religion in places like Nagarjuna-Konda and Nalanda. I guess, first of all, could you talk about both of these places, Nagarjuna-Konda and Nalanda, and then maybe talk about your thoughts as to what caused the decline of Buddhism in India?
Yeah, so Nagarjuna-Konda was a 3rd century CE city. It flourished for about 100 years. It was an offshoot of a larger empire, the Satvahana Empire. And the Nagarjuna-Konda is really represents, it was a major conduit for Buddhism and Brahmanism into the south. So these Buddhism and Brahmanism arose in the north, and the Nagarjuna-Konda was the first major place, the southernmost place rather, where these two religions flourished, and it became, they pushed it down further. And there's some remarkable things happened there. There's the famous philosopher Nagarjuna, who is the founder of Mahayana Buddhism, who lived there. And Nalanda University, of course, it begins around the 5th century, continues till the 12th, 13th centuries, was a major monastery. So some people call it a university. And it attracted student monks from all over Asia who came and studied. It was like, for Buddhist studies, it was like the Harvard of the time for hundreds of years. So, and we know a lot about it now from the Chinese visitors and who left records. So now, what caused this decline of Buddhism in India is... that this decline really happened in the second half of the first millennium. And by the 7th century, the Chinese visitor Xuanzang had noticed the slide, and he wrote about it. I think there were multiple reasons for this decline. I will quickly go through 3 or 4 of them. The first, I think there had been a competitive and hostile dynamic between Brahmanism and Buddhism over both patronage and followers. And in this game, Buddhism at some point started losing out. and partly because Brahmanism was more creative and embraced several popular features of Buddhism. It appropriated them, such as monastic orders, no animal sacrifices, and even took the Buddha as the ninth avatar of Vishnu. And then the second reason is, you know, the Buddhist clergy got a little too complacent. Centuries of royal patronage reduced their dependence on lay people for funding. And so they retreated into these gated monasteries and they kind of cut off their contact with lay people. And the lay people returned the favor and they began shifting to rival religious orders. And a third reason is, like, there was a big churn in the Indian religious market and towards the end of the first millennium with the rise of, you know, Brahminical orthodoxy led by this major figure, Adi Shankara, and the rise of bhakti or mystical devotionalism. And these were more compelling to a lot of people. And this, in this churn, in this religious market, more satisfying products were coming up, and Buddhism was one of the losers. You know, some say because it was a relatively sober and austere faith, and it couldn't really compete with what was coming up. And then another fourth reason is probably that, it did happen that there were declining followers. The kings of the period began shifting to a mostly Brahminical ideology. Earlier, they had divided their patronage between Brahmanism and Buddhism. And this set in a vicious spiral for Buddhism. The funding for monasteries dried up, and many kings even began persecuting Buddhist monks, like in the Sena dynasty in Bengal. By the time of the Turkish invasions, around 1200 CE, Buddhism had vanished from everywhere in India, except for a few small pockets in eastern India. And it was already on life support, awaiting a final push, which was delivered by the Turks. So the decline had many causes, though today, I should note that Hindu nationalists tend to reduce them to just the Turkish invasion, which was, if you look at it, was actually a fairly minor cause. So, that roughly sums it up.
So I'd like to jump forward to another one of the cities you discuss. Make sure I pronounce it correctly. Khajuraho. Now, I think much of that chapter focuses on some of the erotic imagery you see in its temples, which was definitely an interesting chapter to read while on the bus. But you note that this imagery is treated with some awkwardness, I think, by Indians today. First of all, I think, why did the people of Khajuraho focus on eroticism and this erotic imagery? And how did that differ from elsewhere in India? I guess, why is this treated as somehow problematic today?
Exactly. Most Indians are super awkward around this erotic imagery. On medieval temples like the ones in Khajuraho, and it's actually, it wasn't just Khajuraho, and it also happened in a few other parts of India, several parts of India, and they rose and declined roughly together, plus minus a few, years. And so it's, you can study, Khajuraho stands for all of them. And the Indians feel awkward mainly because this imagery comes from a very different religious culture that's now lost to us. So these depictions just seem alien and scandalous to modern Indians. And so what was going on? What drove that imagery was a tantric religious substrate which thrived in the first millennium. In tantrism, which is now really a fringe thing in eastern parts of India, in tantrism, sex and spirituality were deeply intertwined pursuits. So sex, properly guided by tantric principles, was a path to spiritual progress and eventual liberation or moksha. And this was then a popular religious idea, and it stood in direct contrast to Hindu orthodoxy, which glorified austerity, renunciation, and asceticism as the path to God. And this, the Hindu orthodoxy and even the Buddhist had a similar view of the path to God or their path, their spiritual path. Now, the roots of Tantra were really non-Vedic and non-Brahmanical, non-Buddhist. They arose from and were nurtured by a folk spirituality that valued symbols of fertility as auspicious. You know, at first, such symbols were basic and abstract, and they appeared as decorative motifs on temple doorways. And then over centuries, these symbols grew more complex and realistic, and they began evoking the idea of fertility through images of male-female unions. Over time, these images, at first they were just coyly amorous pairs holding hands and so on, like the ones we see in Nagarjuna-konda in the 3rd century CE. And then they moved on to more explicit sexual couplings. Now, across India, it was this tantric belief system embraced by some of the royalty that inspired the erotic art on state-sponsored temples. And so in late first millennium, this substrate began fading in India due to, you know, the same sort of the religious churn that I just described and conflicts within the Hindu fold centuries before the rise of Islamic rule in Delhi. And it was the same churn that had pushed out Buddhism too. I discussed this in the book, but from then on, Hinduism became more orthodox, hierarchical, patriarchal, and puritanical, leading to the down the road to the sexual prudes of today, who are, you know, greatly scandalized by this imagery and are unable to understand where it comes from.
So much of this history is lost, sometimes literally, you know, as you note, in the case of Nagarjuna-konda, much of that site lies at the bottom of a lake after it was flooded due to the construction of a dam. How difficult was it for you to kind of build back the history of these places when writing the book?
Yeah, it varied. I followed a similar process, and there were some variations. So let's take Nagarjuna-konda as an example, which was particularly challenging because, as you just said, it now lies at the bottom of a lake, which was created by a dam on the river Krishna. Now, luckily, a good deal of archaeological work had happened on it between 54 and 60 until the lake covered it. And some of the site's key monuments were relocated to higher ground. So, of course, I visited all these monuments and I studied academic historians who have investigated the site and created a picture of that society. I studied the work of the philosopher Nagarjuna, who was a resident of the city in the 3rd century. I also pored over 2 fat tomes that constitute the detailed archaeological reports. I studied the plan of the city and the location of the city's excavated finds. And I then imagined what a walk down its main avenues might have felt like. What would one have seen back then? And so in the book, I take the reader on that imaginary walk, which is something I'm quite proud of, actually. I wish more history books would do that. And the process with other sites was similar too. It was a combination of reading a diversity of academic histories, archaeological reports, visiting the sites and associated museums, ancient travelers' records, and, you know, any surviving literary works from that period, even talking to present day locals at these sites to add some, you know, color to the narrative. And my focus all along was to tell an engaging story about each place, for the general reader, but one that was that had to be rooted in sound scholarship. That was important to me.
So in between kind of these accounts of different cities, you intersperse these chapters with chapters about some of the foreign visitors who stopped by India during their travels. People like Megasthenes and Chuang Zheng and Al-Biruni and Marco Polo. How reliable are these accounts, and what do we learn from reading them?
Well, yeah, the reliability varies a lot. I mean, these travelers were human, like any of us. They came with their cultural baggage, their blind spots, prejudices. They often didn't know local languages, so things sometimes got lost in translation. They were also, most of them were not scholarly people, except, say, Al-Biruni. Most of them had no role models either. And many of them exaggerated things to just spice things up for audiences back home. So it's challenging. And for the history writer, it's partly an art to decide what to trust. We need to look at other contemporary sources to assess whether an account makes sense. We also need to look for, you know, internal inner logic and consistency and the vividness in each account to assess its trustworthiness. In most cases, I actually offer a discussion on how to interpret a major traveler's words, you know, based on what we know of his character and possible motivations and so on. There is considerable variation here. For example, you know, let's take Megasthenes. He's not skeptical about, you know, hearsay about places he has not visited. He just records them. And many of it is just plainly absurd. But he is good with describing the city of Pataliputra, where he spent 2-3 years. He describes its social life, the Mauryan bureaucracy, even little details like, you know, how elephants were used by humans, how they were captured and trained and used in war and all that. And that's pretty accurate stuff. It's much easier to trust Al-Biruni, who was an astute and insightful observer. Someone like Marco Polo, it's easy to discount his obvious fabrications. But his social observations were often quite spot on. Like, you know, he notes how Indians reserve their left hand for unclean tasks, or they do not use their mouths on flasks and pour the fluid by raising the flask above their mouth. So, like, this is so well entrenched. Who would doubt that? It's just interesting that this existed even back then. I think a fair bit of what we know about Indian history comes from the accounts of foreign travelers. And it's an important pillar of what we know about the past, along with, you know, the other sources of archaeology, literary and texts and inscriptions and so on. A good example here is of the Chinese travelers. They left rich details of Indian social life between the 5th and the 7th centuries. So there are three of them whose records have survived. They describe a range of laws and punishments, taxation, festivals, customs, like the practice of untouchability in the 7th century and so on. And when Buddhism died in India after the 13th century, it disappeared entirely from memory. Indians even forgot that the Buddha was Indian and a founder of a major religion in the subcontinent. It was these Chinese monks' records translated in the 19th century that led to the rediscovery of our Buddhist antiquity. And it's from these Chinese monks that we learn a lot about, you know, even Nalanda. It's what was its admission criteria, what they studied, their debates, how the university was financed. You know, we learn about the greeting protocols between student and teacher, their classroom settings, their walks, bathing routines, all kinds of fascinating stuff. It just makes it easier to imagine an average day in the life of a monk at Nalanda. So these travelers' records are really quite invaluable when read with some caution and care.
So I have one more question, and it's a big question, which is, why did you decide to embark on writing this quite broad and substantive work of history?
Yeah, I've been reading history for about 30 years, and for nearly as long, I've been fascinated by cities that were entirely lost to memory and had to be dug out, and their stories then built up from scratch. And I've visited dozens of such lost cities around the world. In 2004, I took a break from my work in Silicon Valley, and I traveled in India for 2 years, pretty much nonstop, visiting all the places I write about in this book. I remember being struck by questions for which answers were not easy to find, at least for me. You know, questions like, what was it like to live in the city of Dholavira in a very vivid sense? You know, what habits and ways of the Harappans are still with us today? What sort of urban milieu produced an amazing thinker like Nagarjuna? What was it like to be a student at Nalanda? You know, I didn't find easy answers to these sorts of questions. And what we just discussed, what religious worldview allowed the sort of erotica that we find on temples in Khajuraho, and why did it disappear? So with questions like these, I began digging, and I looked up academic histories and original sources and travelers' accounts, and one thing led to another. I began writing short pieces on some of these sites and travelers, and in time, I started connecting the dots into a larger civilizational arc and learning about the most significant trends and transformations and fault lines of Indian civilization. And this happened over 15 years or so. You know, as I read, traveled, reflected on these places, I moved back to India, and eventually a vision for this sort of a book emerged. I pitched it to Penguin, and they liked the idea very much. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history.
So I think that's a great place to end our interview with Namit Arora, author of Indians, A Brief History of a Civilization. Namit, one actual last question for you. Where can people find your work, and what's next for you?
Yeah, I have three books. I think if you just search my name, Namit Arora, I have a website, namitarora.com. And through there, you can find my essays and various places, and also all of my three books and how to acquire them around the world. And what's next? I am currently just taking it slow, and I'm just reading a lot. You know, when you are working on a big project like this book, a lot of other reading has to take a backseat. And I had built up like this big pile of books. So I'm just working through those, and I might work on some book reviews. And then let's see what book-length project appeals to me next. I'm not settled on it at this point.
Well, I look forward to hearing about what comes next. So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you've subscribed to listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Larry Fain, author of The Flower Boat Girl. But before then, Thank you so much, Namit, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Nicholas. Enjoyed it.